The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin our journey with the enduring echoes of Moorish Spain. This article appeared in the August 30th, 2022 issue of the New York Times. Writer Nina Burley explores southern Spain's Arab influence with its intricate geometric designs and castles and grand mosques reconfigured by Christians into cathedrals. So let's learn more as we begin our journey in Moorish Spain. There is a way through Spain that is all horseshoe arches, keyhole windows, and bronze doors carved in Arabic script. It meanders into crenellated forts, Moorish castles overlooking the Mediterranean, and grand mosque reconfigured by Christians into cathedrals. As the child of an Iraqi woman and a Swedish-American man, I have always been drawn to places where West and East converge and dissolve into each other. The southern edge of Spain, where North Africa is just an hour away by water, is one of those places. One midsummer week, my husband and I immersed ourselves in what remains of Moorish Spain, places that brought to mind the sights, sounds, and scents of childhood visits to my mother's homeland. We took an impossibly romantic path through Seville, Cordoba, Granada, Malaga, the port city of Tarifa, and finally by ferry across the Strait of Gibraltar to Tangier, Morocco. Arab influence in Spain dates to the early 700s, not long after the founding of Islam, when Muslims from North Africa crossed the Strait of Gibraltar from the Arabic for Turax Rock. The Europeans called the invaders Moors, after Mauritania, the Roman name for North Africa. Over the centuries, the Moors left a legacy in Spanish architecture, music, food, and language in the region they called Al-Andalus. The name of Spain's greatest hero, El Cid, comes from the Arabic honorific Said. The 16th century novelist Miguel de Cervantes framed his fictional story of the knights errant, Don Quixote, as the translation of a recovered Arabic manuscript. Where cultures meet and endure. We started off in Seville, the capital of the South Andalusia region, arriving as a sunset haze made gold silhouettes of church domes and former minarets on the skyline. The slow, pale green river that flows through both Seville and Cordoba is called the Guadalquivir, a Spanish pronunciation of the Arabic Wadi al-Kabir, or Big Valley. Many other rivers in Spain contain the same Arabic root word for valley or riverbed, like the Guadalmedina and the Guadiana. Early in the morning, we hit our jet lag with double espressos and bizcocho, a sweet spongy cake, then strolled what is still called the Jewish Quarter, despite the Jews' expulsion over 500 years ago, past houses painted in the colors of hay and bull's blood, to the Seville Cathedral and the Alcazar, that's the Moorish ruler's castle and gardens. Throughout Andalusia, there is no clear-cut line between Christian and Muslim architecture. The Spanish Christians, who eventually conquered the Moors and expelled the Muslims and the Jews during the Inquisition, starting in 1492, didn't tear down all the Moorish work. They applied Muslim decorative motifs to their own architecture in a design called mutijar, a word that also refers to the Muslims the Christians allowed for a time to remain. In one convent that we visited in Seville, for example, icons of haloed saints and a crucified Christ hang under ceilings with intricate patterns of inlaid wood. The two cultures and their stylistic differences, the Islamic preference for complex geometry, and the Christian depiction of living creatures exist side by side. A seat of coexistence and progress. From Seville, we drove east along the Guadalquivir to Cordoba, which has been called the ornament of the world. Our first night in Cordoba, we woke just before dawn to a quavering wail wafting through an open hotel window. For a moment, I was back in the Baghdad summer of my childhood, sleeping on the rooftop of my grandmother's house on little beds with mosquito nets, when the same sound would wake me in the starlit night. Muezzins, who are called Muslims to prayer, have not sounded from the Christianized minarets of Andalusia, Spain's largest region, for centuries. But the Duende Day of Flamenco happens, and maybe not by accident, to sound much the same. Duende is a complex Spanish word that means spirit, magic, passion. It is also the name for the plaintive, wordless singing in Spain's signature folk music. Musicologists are unsure of flamenco's origins. One etymology, proposed by the 19th-century Andalusian historian Blas Infantat, said that the word flamenco comes from the Arabic words for rural wander. Certainly, the emotional keening evokes the human and cultural loss and ghost of hundreds of thousands of Jews and Muslims thrown out of Spain after seven centuries of coexistence. Cordoba's Mosque Cathedral, or Las Mezquita, is another UNESCO World Heritage Site. Here, the physical and spiritual contrast between Islam and Christianity are embedded in the walls. The massive mosque, covering nearly 261,000 square feet, was built in 784 and then expanded by succeeding generations of Muslim rulers known as caliphs. It was one of the first and grandest mosques in Europe, a forest of 586 columns supporting 365 red and white striped arches. The arrangement of the pillars gives the illusion of shifting diagonal lines. The simplicity and vastness suggest an unadorned void, ideal for contemplating eternity. Standing before the one center of color, the glowing, surreal mihrab, the Mecca-facing prayer niche found in the mosque, inlaid with precious stones, is like staring into the sun. In the midst of this icon of Islamic architecture, 16th-century Spanish Catholics implanted a Gothic cathedral. Today, in the heart of this forest of arches, Christ on the cross hangs over a central nave lined with tall silver and gold candlesticks. Crowned gilt-plaster Madonnas peek out of Islamic keyhole-shaped niches. Dozens of porticos along the outer walls are bricked in and divided into dark, gated rooms holding saints' bones and candle-lit altars. Viewed from the top of the nearby bell tower, the former minaret, which one can climb for a few euros, an alien Gothic buttress spaceship appears to have landed in the middle of the roof. Muslims are prohibited by the Catholic Church from praying inside the mosque cathedral. In the early 1970s, the Saudi government offered to pay Spain millions of dollars to move the cathedral out of the mosque and construct it nearby. Spain's former dictator, Francisco Franco, supported the idea, but the cathedral's bishops and others opposed it, and ultimately the plan was shelved. At its zenith, from roughly the late 8th through the 10th centuries, Cordoba was a place of unusually peaceful coexistence between Christians, Jews, and Muslims. Sometimes, la convivencia during this period, Jewish and Christian intellectuals from all over Europe came to the Moorish seat of power, translating classical texts from Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, and advancing studies of medicine, philosophy, math, and astronomy. Historians are not in full agreement about the extent of Andalusian tolerance then, and even today conflicts persist over who gets to pray inside La Mezquita. But in an interview with me over coffee not far from the Mosque Cathedral, the Cordoba University lawyer and historian Antonio Manuel Rodriguez Ramos argued that La convivencia was real. Here in Cordoba, he says, within 500 meters you find the mosque, the chapel of St. Bartholomew, and the synagogue. They prayed together. The convivencia existed, and it ended when Jews and Moors were expelled, he said. Besides art, language, music, and architecture, the Moors left their mark on Andalusian agriculture and cuisine. Among the crops they introduced are pomegranate, eggplant, chickpeas, and asparagus, which was considered a weed before they cultivated it, the white version of what is now Spanish delicacy. Paco Morales, a young Cordoban chef, has earned himself two Michelin stars for his restaurant called Noor, Arabic for light, on a nondescript suburban street. He serves a multi-course meal of delicacies using only ingredients available during the Moorish centuries. I imagine myself cooking for modern-day caliphs, he said, then named one. Abd al-Aram was alive. Were he alive today, what would he like to eat, he said. A castle in the clouds. The crown of all Moorish castles is the magnificent Alhambra in Granada. It hovers like a city, like a mirage, a castle in the clouds. Strolling this labyrinth of Murana, a honey-like comb, ornamental vaulting, and ornate white stucco walls is like a surreal trip in a giant vitrine of carved ivory. The vast complex is said to be laid out as a complicated geometric game. Evidence of an intense focus on math is everywhere. The placement of star-like patterns embedded in the arch ceilings, for example, required countless complicated calculations by human brains, not machines. British and American writers, including Washington Irving and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, have waxed lyrical trying to describe, usually moonlit splendor, a Alhambra. Some of them even spent a night or two sleeping on tiled floors among its trickling fountains and delicate arched porticos. We stayed in a small hotel with a Moorish-style central courtyard called the Casa Morisca. It's perched on a hill across and from and far below the castle, where the Darro River once sustained the great compound trickles along the outdoor cafes of the Paseo de los Tristes. The Alhambra was the first, or rather the final stronghold, of the last Muslim rulers in Spain, the Nasrids. The handover of its keys to the Catholic Jews, with Christopher Columbus present at the ceremony, about to set off for the West, marked the end of 781 years of Moorish Spain. It is also a name that still resonates in the Arab world, where generations of people like my mother, a Christian raised in Muslim Iraq, grew up hearing of this storied place, but who, like her, never visited. Below the towers, Granada bustles with university students, tapas bars, and outdoor cafes, a shopping district, even a covered souk. Here you can smell the azafrán, Arabic and Spanish for saffron, emanating from tiny, clear plastic containers. Only in Granada did I see tourist shops selling souvenir T-shirts with the town's name in Arabic script. On the steep lanes on the hill across from the Alhambra, the Carmens, that's walled properties of the medieval Abbasin neighborhood, don't advertise their splendid terrace gardens and stupendous views. At the very top of the neighborhood in the Plaza Larga, a pastelería sells the most insanely indulgent breakfast treat I've ever eaten with coffee. Sponge cake, topped with custard and filled with milky pudding like a tres leches cake. After breakfast, we drove to Malacca, a favorite beach destination for Britons on the Costa del Sol, and also home to one of the largest Muslim fort and castle complexes in Spain. There, we spent half a day strolling the vertiginous gardens and arched porticos of Alcazaba of Malacca, Malaga. The compound was built by the same Moorish rulers who constructed the Alhambra and overlooks coastal high-rises, the port, and the sea, and is a good tapas and wine-burning hike up a mountain. In other words, get plenty to eat before you go. On the final leg of the journey, we drove south as far as we could go. The outlines of the edge of another continent, the North African homeland of the original Moors, and the land to which many of the expelled Jews and Muslims fled, slowly appeared in the haze across the Mediterranean. Passports in hand, we boarded a ferry in the little port of Tarifa, named after the Moorish military commander Tarif Ibn Malik, an origin of the English word for import taxes, the tariff. The short-storied crossing between the continents, or two continents, had long been a dream of mine. For 45 minutes I was transfixed by the waves lapping the side of the ship, thinking of the water's role in centuries of migration and blended cultures. We left Europe behind and docked in another world, in Tangier, Morocco, an Arab city whose streets, like the Baghdad of my memory, smell of orange blossom and diesel. Descendants of those expelled from Spain still live in the northern coastal regions of Morocco, covered in a new documentary, Children of Al-Andalus. Some even possess real or symbolic keys to their lost houses. One of these descendants, Abdel el-Akil, has a large iron key passed down for hundreds of years to the eldest male of his family. According to family lore, the first Al-Aqil was a wealthy Nasrid builder who fled Granada in 1492 and built the first mosque in the Moroccan city of Chechaouen. Al-Aqil is also the name of the mosque. Spain has offered to repatriate descendants of the expelled Jews, but it has not extended that invitation to Muslims, although some have asked. Mr. Al-Aqil says he has no desire for Spanish citizenship. The family doesn't even know what building their key supposedly wants to unlock, but Mr. Al-Aqil, a lean, quiet, retired architect and banker who invited me to meet at his summer home in Tetuan on the Mediterranean coast, kept his family heritage alive by educating his three children in Spanish schools from childhood. They attended universities in Spain, and all three are now living and working in Granada, the first members of the family to return after four centuries. The key, by the way, stayed in Morocco. Our writer, Nina Burley, is a journalist and author, and most recently her published book, Virus, Vaccinations, the CDC, and the Hijacking of America's Response to the Pandemic. So there we go. Well, now we're going to continue our journey by traveling east to Asia as we prepare for our next stop. Consider when you may have traveled on a whim. That's kind of a hint. One of those times where you just up and went. You've done that before? Well, no real planning, you just simply wanted to go, right? Well, perhaps that's where some friends were going. Maybe. Well, writer Lily Radzymski shares such an experience in her article, Going with the Flow on an Impulsive Trip to Thailand. And her story appeared in the September 16th, 2022 issue of the Washington Post. So let's see what she did. On the southwestern coast of Thailand, limestone cliffs tower over seawater against the backdrop of swaying trees. Long tailboats, the only means of transportation to Rayleigh Beach, sit parked on the distance, neon pink and green flags swaying at the bow. Sand bubbler crabs dip above and below the surface, leaving their intricate designs at the mercy of high tide and flip-flops. I'm sitting in a bar in the beach, watching water droplets fall down my ice-cold Shinga beer, looking at the sunset glimmer on the water. Picturesque doesn't even begin to describe this. There's just one question on my mind. How did I end up here? A few weeks earlier, I was fantasizing about going somewhere, anywhere, far away. I craved the feeling of being lost in an unfamiliar city, soaking in its sounds, smells, energy. This led to casually browsing plane tickets to Southeast Asia, where a reasonably priced ticket to Bangkok popped up. Later that month, I boarded the plane with a friend who booked her trip a few days after mine. While jetting across the world on a whim admittedly made me feel pretty cocky, it turns out I'm part of a larger trend. According to data from the online travel company Skyscanner, demand focused on the Asia-Pacific region and Thailand in particular has taken off since coronavirus restrictions began to ease in April, and that would be of this year. During May and June, for example, it was the third most popular long-haul destination from France, where I live. Beyond the uptick in trips to the region, Matt Bradford, who analyzes trends and insights for Skyscanner, has identified short booking horizons, a window of 30 days or less between booking and takeoff, as a new behavior. He explained by phone that in France during May and June, 39% of bookings made on the site were for departures within 1 month. In the United States, that figure was 35%. Everything you need to know about traveling to Thailand is the next section. When the doors slide open at Bangkok's Souvanomay Airport, it hits you, wet, sweltering heat. Within 1 minute, my skin was covered in a slick film of humidity and sweat, and dripping down the back of my neck as we hopped into the cab. We drove past roadside dumpling joints, skyscrapers, and a seemingly endless string of stalls selling sex toy souvenirs. The next afternoon, after a delicious lunch at Rung Ryong Pork Noodle, a bare-bones, plastic-stool, fan-blasting haven for pork meatballs, noodles, and broth, we set off toward Wat Arun, a temple built during the Ayutthaya era on the bank of the Chao Phraya River. Its praying towers more than 200 feet overhead, intricately decorated with porcelain pieces and walkways that snake up and around it. As we were strolling through the grounds, a lady approached us, offering a boat ride around a nearby floating market. Our boat driver soon led us through the Thornberry network of clongs or canals lined with worn wooden houses, many tilting on the stilts holding them above the water. A woman wearing a straw hat with bows clipped onto the man slowly approached us in her long tailboat, offering bracelets, keychains, and flowery hair clips. After we politely declined, she reached into her cooler, emerging with a grin. Beer? While this normally wouldn't send me over the edge with excitement, Bangkok had banned alcohol sales for 24 hours during its election, and a cold Chang sounded pretty good in that heat. I bought one for myself and our driver, and we continued to drift through the canals. I'm no floating market expert, but let's just say this one was slightly underwhelming. After a quick snack of fried quail eggs with soy sauce and sugar, we set off back toward Bangkok and spent the evening on a rooftop paying for drinks with crypto. That's the bar's only payment option. The next 2 days would see endless heaps of sausages splattering into hot oil on street food carts, 3 a.m. massages, Khao San Road is where that is, and then you walk down the side streets of Sumhambit. Then after being seduced by travelers and locals raving about the south, they generally urged us to avoid Phuket, the notorious destination for tourists looking to get lost in the black hole of its nightlife, we hopped on a plane. After the intense electric urban energy of Bangkok, Krabi, a southern province on Thailand's Andaman Sea, was literally breath of fresh air. We hopped into a shuttle that made of various drop-offs in towns throughout the area, and the driver played American country music as we drove past lush greenery on winding roads, passing a shooting range on the way into Annang. A tourist, probably in her 20s, was talking to the woman next to her. "We don't really have a plan," she said, and they weren't the only ones. In Krabi, we set off by long-tail boat to explore the Koh Phota, Koh Tap, and Koh Kai, or Chicken Islands, off the coast within the Phi Islands National Park. To say our first stop looked like a postcard would be a vast understatement. If you've ever imagined yourself on a deserted island, gazing out into crystal-clear waters under the shade of a mango tree on a white sand beach, this was that. There was no one else in sight as we dived into the calm water, splashing around gleefully with silly grins on our faces. I soon started to notice some stinging on my upper arm. Thinking I was being hypochondriac, I ignored it. A couple of minutes later, back on shore, my friend mentioned that her arm was stinging, but reasoned it was probably because of the salt water and sunburn combination. When we finally connected the dots about our ailments, we strolled back to inspect the water. As it turns out, the deserted white sand beach wasn't deserted after all, but was instead full of massive, translucent jellyfish in the water and washed ashore, a small detail we didn't register on our walk from the boat. Our driver didn't seem too concerned, though. When asked whether the stings were dangerous, he laughed, shook his head, and said, "No dead, no dead," still chuckling as he returned to the stern. On our last night, we returned to Rayleigh Beach via a long-tail boat, tilting dramatically against the waves, water splashing into the boat through the open sides. After wading through the water to get to shore, we dropped off our stuff and hit the beach bar. Hotel California played in the background as the sun disappeared over the horizon, revealing stars and the vast surrounding cliffs shining the moonlight. Then the power went out. After a few minutes, the bartender created a makeshift glowing lantern by putting his phone flashlight under a bottle of Curacao. Candles were lit. We asked for another round. "Why not?" he replied. A wander through the pitch-black town revealed shadows of massage ladies chatting quietly while huddled together, looking out into the pathway. Bartenders hung outside, just their silhouettes visible in the darkness. In one bar, candles cast a glowing light over a pool table beyond the open windowsills, an acoustic guitar player singing behind it. We spent a few hours in that bar as rains flooded the road outside. Behind us, the bartender kept laughing to himself, repeating, "Why not?" seemingly the town's unofficial catchphrase, every couple of minutes. We couldn't make out the faces of the people opposite us, just their shadows. Reality felt conflated with a sort of dream world, in a good way. Suddenly, the lights came on. Almost immediately, the place that couldn't have felt farther away from home made me think of the bars in Rue de l'Alpe. the notoriously rowdy party street in my Paris neighborhood, characterized by neon lights and flaming shots. Acoustic music quickly faded behind the top 40 songs blasting on the stereo, and fairy lights blinked aggressively on the walls. It was time to go. The next morning, I left Krebby, already feeling nostalgic, as that night shifted from reality into memory on my journey back to Paris. I'm not advocating for always traveling without a plan. We missed a lot. The one thing we really wanted to do, travel by train from north to south, wasn't possible without booking ahead. Our floating market experience could have benefited from better research. We could have seen more sights, but if someone had asked me, would you like to take a rickety, long-tailed boat in high swells to this isolated beach town that will lose power, where you'll essentially be stranded until morning? I'd say, why not? By the way, Lily Radzymski is a writer based in Paris, and you can find her on Twitter and Instagram. Just check at Lily Rads, LILYRADZ. Now, if you'd like to consider an impulsive trip to Thailand, Radzymski does give you some tips. Let's see what she offers. As far as if you go, where to eat, of course, is going to be on the menu, so to speak. Rung Ryung Pork Noodle is in Bangkok, and this is pork, bone broth, and noodles king here. Hot, crowded, delicious, open daily, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. These are local times. And the main-ish dishes start at about $2. Then there's a place called Family Thai Food and Seafood in Krabi, and that's spelled K-R-A-B-I. This is a no-frills restaurant serving up delicious, fresh classics and seafood. I'm still dreaming about the tom yum soup and fresh passion fruit juice. Now, this is open 10 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. daily, and the main dishes start at about $3. And then we have the Eo Nang Landmark Night Market in Krabi, and the stalls in this night market have many options, such as dried squid skins, classic noodle dishes, and freshly grilled squid. You can eat them in an open table. And it's open Monday to Saturday, 4 to 10 p.m. on Sunday until 10:30 p.m. And the main dishes start at about $2.50. Then we have the Luna Beach Bar in Muang Ao Nang. Now, this bar has a spacious terrace that opens to the beach. Watch the long-tail boats come and go, and the paddleboarders row into the sunset. There's a full dining menu. The food's fresh and delicious. It's open daily 10 a.m. to 2 a.m., bottle of beer from about $1.50. Then we have Reeve Coffee, and that's R-E-E-V-E, Reeve Coffee, Ao Nang Miang Krabi District. This delicious coffee shop with an outdoor terrace overlooking the water, it's pricier than most cafes in the area, but the coffee with fresh coconut makes it worth it. Open daily, and coconut coffee starts at about $5. As far as what to do, we have Rayleigh Beach, and that's spelled R-A-I-L-A-Y, and it's in the Muang Krabi region. And online, you can check them out at touristsmithand.org, attraction/Rayleigh, R-A-L-A-Y hyphen beach. And tourist is T-O-U-R-S, tourism, Thai, T-H-A-I. Land, L-A-N-D, tourismthailand.org, so check all that out. A beach town with a laid-back vibe and stunning landscapes. It also attracts people for rock climbing. Despite not being an island, the beach is accessible only by long-tail boats. So there you go, your next adventure coming up. And for us, that ends today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.